Professor Stephen Chan is world-renowned in international relations, professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And he was also the first keynote speaker at the first Martial Arts Studies conference. So he'll always have a very special place in my heart for that reason alone. So Stephen, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
And you're on lockdown in London at the moment?
Well, insofar as lockdown is not being flouted, but of course there's a minor release in lockdown today.
Yeah.
But we're still basically self-isolating as a safety precaution.
Yeah. So you were the first keynote at our first conference, and it really all it hinged on you and it hinged on your availability. I thought I want to have a conference. I didn't know how big it would be, and I thought, well, who would be a great keynote speaker? And it was you, because you have such an interesting relationship with martial arts, in the sense that it's been a central part of your personal life, and your academic career has gone elsewhere, but it's also been intertwined. I mean, you're not primarily a scholar of martial arts, are you?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm primarily, officially, a scholar of international relations. I mean, I write that quite large.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time in Africa, so I teach African politics, for instance. And I'm deeply interested in the different thought beliefs of the world. So I also teach religion and world politics. That's something inclined to get me into a lot of trouble, of course, right now. But because I spend a lot of time in the Far East, certainly over the years, then I have from time to time written about martial arts as it's practiced in the Far East, but also how the Far East itself is impacted by the West and by international currents. I mean, you can't teach Far Eastern martial arts in Africa, for instance, without some kind of interaction and some kind of influence of one culture, one continent to the other. So I'm very, very much interested in that kind of multiculturalism and that kind of intersection. I mean, as you would have heard at that keynote lecture I gave for you, the last thing I think is that tradition should be static. I mean, tradition is not a museum. I'm very, very strong on that. It has to develop. Otherwise, it has no value for our times. It's hard to develop tradition in a way that doesn't lose sight of some of its original values, but brings on board some of the international contemporary values that are now unavoidable. I think that's the trick. And so I'm prepared to write about that from time to time, but most of my writing is very, very much to do with international politics and international diplomacy.
Yeah, I think everyone has different memorable, they took away different memorable things from that keynote. The thing that stuck with me, and I've seen this a lot in conversations with other academics in martial arts studies, is you did this. You said martial arts don't change like this. And you did, for anyone who's listening, you gestured like, it's not like the rain through time. It's martial arts don't change like this. They change like this. And you turned your hands so your fingers faced each other. And martial arts, the martial arts develop in communication with other things that are happening at this moment. It's not like one master, then a disciple changes something, then a disciple changes something. Although that does happen, but the motive of it, the force of it, is the communication with other things that are happening at that time.
I think that's absolutely the case, and I'll stand by that. I had actually forgotten I made that gesture, but now you've reminded me of it. But even in Japan, for instance, Japan was not completely isolated. It had all kinds of influences from surrounding countries, from China, just by virtue of trading routes alone, and of course from Korea. And the martial arts that I primarily study from Okinawa, well, Okinawa is a complete crossroads. You have all kinds of influences coming backwards and forwards from China, from mainland Japan, from Korea. And because of nothing else but trade, but also because of scholarship, because of shared religions, all of these things meant that martial arts was not exempt from this kind of crossover influence. So to think that anything is pure in itself and remains pure once it's been declared pure is, I think, a complete misnomer about how culture intersects. I mean, I've got to Okinawa quite a number of times, and on a very, very clear day, because pollution has, of course, reached that part of the world as well, but I can actually see the outline of the coast of China from one of the peninsulas in Okinawa. I mean, it's just faintly visible in the distance. So this means that even a fisherman knew how to navigate to China. So the tales of people like Iguana, the founder of Goju, and other people going backwards and forwards to learn from southern Chinese styles, the whole legend of, I regard them largely as Chinese pirates and mercenaries, setting their ships into port in Okinawa. All of that, I think, meant a miscegenation of the arts. And of course, some of these cities, city-states in Okinawa, traded with Japan in a very, very big fashion. I mean, Kyoto was, at that point in time, a major center not only of culture, but of international trade. You can't go backwards and forwards without picking up influences, without being heavily impacted by what you see, particularly if you're a tiny island state and you go to the big smoke, as it were, you're going to pick up stuff. And it's this kind of interaction which has always fascinated me. And of course, it continues today. I mean, after the end of World War II, we had permanent American garrisons and bases and airfields in Okinawa. They didn't go away because of the intensity of the Cold War. They're still there now because of the perceived threat from North Korea. I've absolutely witnessed the effect and the influence of American students on Okinawan masters. It's not just that the old men in their wisdom are impacting upon young, callow American servicemen. You know, a lot of these servicemen were young champions back home in America. And I've watched the masters learn one or two things from them. This is often overlooked. People are not blind to what they see around them. They're influenced by what is around them.
Interesting. So you were born in New Zealand, and did you study your karate or different styles of martial arts in New Zealand, or what's this? What was your first encounter?
Well, yes, it was in New Zealand, but I think I gave an interview at your first conference, in fact, your colleague, Dr. Judd, on exactly some of those aspects of my formation. I absolutely have to blame my grandmother. We called her the Dragon Lady. Just to encapsulate that particular interview, she'd been a swordswoman in her village militia. She was a bit of a militia leader in the warlord era of the first part of the 20th century. You have to remember that China was in complete chaos at the beginning of the 20th century. What you had was the disintegration of the emperor system, all kinds of very valiant but not successful efforts to establish a modern republic. Very heroic efforts to do so. The beginnings of a communist way of looking at things that all the same suffered all kinds of setbacks, with international helpers, I hasten to add. But also because of the breakdown of lawlessness, because there was no one established government, warlords or bandit gangs ruled the countryside. So to defend themselves, the villagers took up arms. And my grandmother was, as I said, a militia leader. So she was a swordswoman. So when the family managed to make it to New Zealand during World War II, I think they scrambled on a New Zealand troop ship as it was evacuating soldiers from Hong Kong, literally just before it fell to the Japanese. They'd made the long trek from Guangzhou, Canton, as it was called back then, to Hong Kong, and managed, from the mercy of the soldiers and the sailors on that ship, to get on board. Well, they wound up in New Zealand. So I was born there to a refugee family. And basically, my grandmother insisted that all this kind of stuff was real. Of course, what happens, and I think it happens to every single young man, especially the firstborn in the family, you start to rebel at a certain point in time. Grandma, dad, mom, I don't want this kind of shit anymore. I take myself off to the meanest, toughest, roughest, most notorious karate studio in town that had that kind of reputation. But the teacher was a young champion. He taught in an experimental fashion. It was actually the Malaysian branch of the JKA, the because it was Malaysian, was overlaid with all kinds of influences from the Chinese community in Malaysia.
Yeah.
So essentially, it was a hybrid style, but because of the Chinese influences, I could immediately recognize similarities with what my grandmother had been trying to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the beginning of formal instruction. By that stage, I was a university student.
Mm-hmm.
So that was built upon the early teachings of my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what I regarded as the posturings of my father. You know, the young bull always wants to take on the old bull. I could never beat up on my father anyway, no matter how hard I tried. He was as strong as an ox. But what this did was to take me through basically an adult lifetime of going to different places, learning from different teachers, and being open to study different arts.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, if you have a Malaysian Chinese influenced JKA, it's not going to be straightforward Tokyo JKA.
Yeah.
So I was able to perceive the influences even in that kind of early formal formation. And so when I finally got myself to graduate school in London, I wasn't just content with studying with JKA or in those days KUGB teachers in London. I used to go to a Noida Dojo, for instance, and study with some of his senior students. But I took myself around. I basically bummed my way through pretty much every single dojo in London.
Okay. So do you still mix it up with different people? Do you invite people into your dojo? Or, I mean, what's your syllabus like now?
No, in fact, what we have in the Jindokai, which is the group that I'm the chairman, of which I'm the chairman, I mean, we have a number of different styles, all led by people who've attained teaching rank, proper teaching rank in those styles. So we study Shotokan. I still practice the kata. Shorinuru, the Okinawan style. Goju-ryu, both as it's taught in Okinawa, but also the Goju-kai variant that you get out of Tokyo. I was taught by Sensei Yamaguchi, for instance, the so-called cat. Very notorious figure. What we're looking for is not whether or not you're doing the kata exactly according to a particular school or a particular teacher, but whether you understand the inner meanings of that kata. I mean, we're working very, very much in terms of bunkai. This seems very extreme and strange to most people, but we produce championship kata competitors, for instance. And let's make no secret about that. That show and choreography, it's a bit like modern gymnastic floor display. We have no shame about that. But we are very, very anxious that those same competitors who win gold medals in international competitions, also back home in the dojo, when they're practicing the flashy side of their moves, also appreciate the deeper internal interpretations. Also, we're very, very anxious that those interpretations, those applications, don't follow just some kind of set textbook. I mean, if you're a literature student, it's very obvious that when you read Shakespeare, for instance, you can get a whole different set of meanings from Shakespeare, including meanings that Shakespeare himself had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you take a play like Hamlet, we now understand that Hamlet obviously had a Freudian complex. But Freud hadn't been born, of course, at the time of Shakespeare. There's a latter-day interpretation that makes complete sense. And yet you can't possibly go to an English literature course at university without being given a Freudian interpretation of Shakespeare's Hamlet. And it's perfectly valid in terms of our times. It would have been complete nonsense in Shakespeare's time. So what I try to teach my students is that, look, what you've got are a certain core set of principles. I mean, the plot of Hamlet doesn't change.
Mm.
That's constant. Shakespeare wrote it. The storyline is the storyline. But the way you interpret it changes with time.
Mm.
You can't change the storyline, but you can change the interpretation. For instance, now with certain self-defense movements, and we can interpret it to mean a disarm of somebody with a pistol. Well, pistols didn't exist in the time of the ancient Chinese martial arts or the ancient Okinawan arts or the ancient Japanese arts. That was ridiculous. So how we deal with things now is very, very different with the way that we would have expected people to have dealt with them sometime before. And I think we have lots of misgivings. Maybe we've watched or made too many films about these things. But a lot of these things, these so-called early interpretations, were like what we would now regard as video games. They were fantasy. Quite frankly, if I were an Okinawan peasant and I was confronted by a samurai with a katana, I'm going to die. End of story. Yeah. I don't care if I've got a pair of tofu or bow. I'm going to die.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of being able to resist these things was part of the heroic epics of resistance, which very often were not very successful.
Yeah. I remember when I went to a conference a long time ago when I was only just recently freshly minted kind of PhD graduate. And it was there was a talk precisely about literature. And the professor, whose name now escapes me, his question was for his keynote was, what does the artwork know that I don't? And at the time, I thought that was a preposterous question. But now, like, if I'm doing a kata or a Tai Chi form or anything, it's like, so I've been given this blueprint and it's now my job to, and this morning I was doing Tai Chi and I was in this position and I was thinking about, I'll sit up a bit. So I was thinking about the number of times that this position exists. Yeah. It's like, it's nunchakus, it's an arm lock, it's a throw. It's everything, and it's just this sort of logic here. It's this sort of thing, but like the idea that there's one interpretation of that. I mean, it's a field of possibilities, isn't it?
Indeed, and I've had this pretty much demonstrated on me, much to my discomfort and pain. Exactly that movement, in fact, as well as a few others. When I was I've been a visiting professor in Taiwan a few times, and it's a very, very convenient springboard to go on to Okinawa before coming back to Europe, for instance. Mm-hmm. But my students have always tried to find me a different martial arts teacher whenever I go there. And on this occasion, they found the deputy of Chen Manqing, one of the most illustrious interpreters of the Yang style of Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. There's a variant basically named after Chen Manqing. This was his younger, his collaborator in his younger days. And so they arranged what I was told was going to be a private lesson for me.
Exactly. That was worrying.
So we saw her up to the park, and of course the master is waiting. But so are all his students.
Oh, good.
So we go through the form a couple of times. You know, there has to be some courtesy before the beating up begins. And then he announces to his students, who are all lining up in a very polite fashion, look, we have here Professor Chan, who's a very famous karate master. We will now put on a demonstration of comparison for you. And of course, when they say, let's compare, you know you're going to die. At the same time, you're mindful that you've got some pride. So it's impolite to beat up on the master. Mm. At the same time, you've got to make him work.
Yeah.
So the master says, please attack me as hard as you can. And I thought, well, I better make a good show of this. So I steam in, not meaning to hurt him, but I'm not exactly being gentle. And the next thing I know is I'm flying all over the park. And so I think I'm losing face here. So I ramp up the attacks. He keeps encouraging me to have a go at him. And every time I find myself flying all over the park. And I'm thinking, what's he doing? And you only really realize what he's doing in retrospect when you recreate it all late at night because you can't sleep. Basically, all of his hand movements are straight out of what we would normally call an Aikijutsu or an Aikido playbook.
Okay.
But he's not moving like an Aiki master. He's not doing the Tenkans. He's not basically using any footwork at all. And this really, really mystified me. And what I came to understand I constant replaying in my mind and trying to picture it over and over again in my mind. And he was 72 by this point in time. It was the utter fluidity of his waist. He could do with his waist what an Aiki master has to use a Tenkan to be able to do. The pivot, the step and the pivot that you get out of an Aiki master, he could do in place solely by turning his waist and dropping his weight while he was turning his waist. Dropping his weight and then extending his weight forward as he came out of his waist turn. Now, that's impossible to do without a lifetime of cultivation. At the same time, the projection of energy he got out of a fully subtle movement left a profound impression on me. Now, you're not going to get any Tai Chi teachers, I'm going to say that, in Britain, who'll be able to teach you that, because none of them can do it like that. This was one of the great pioneers of Tai Chi. And it left such a profound impression. And of course, it leads you to ask the question, well, how authentic is what the other Tai Chi masters, how authentic is that, what they're teaching? Are they scratching a surface and then passing that off as authenticity? But of course, you have to realize that not everybody can be the perfect master. You know, I've been very, very fortunate in studying with people who've come very, very close to what you would call a level of at least very near perfection. But sometimes we're making the best of what we get. What I don't appreciate is when we fetishize that and say that this is absolutely gospel. It's not. It's somebody's effort to come close to being gospel.
So, I mean, this leads to the question of, you know, we're all very busy people. We've got to hold down jobs. Like someone like yourself is traveling around the world on all sorts of different, for all sorts of different purposes. And a lot of people, as they get older, not just academics, but all the people, they don't have enough time to train. So how do you manage to maintain the academic responsibilities and roles and your institutional roles and your international roles and keep up your training?
Well, I run a very large martial arts organization. We have 50 dojos around the world. It's all on a non-for-profit basis. There's a sister charity which disperses educational and health aid to karate students, young karate students in some of the countries in which we teach. I've been the dean of three faculties in British universities, which is like being the vice president of a corporation these days, because even the smallest university is going to turn over 100 million per year. And that's pretty much like a small corporation, which means that all your time is spent with lawyers and accountants, nothing academic about it, as well as keeping up a full academic practice of teaching and writing, as well as my private practice in terms of diplomatic work, which is a pro bono free of charge activity for governments with whom I sympathize, including from time to time, I hasten to add, our own government here in the United Kingdom. So basically, you're looking at about five full-time jobs there. But I train every day, and it's at least an hour. It's an average of 90 minutes. It's certainly getting harder now as I'm getting older, and that happens to all of us, of course. But you've simply got to ask yourself the question as to, well, what does this mean to you? If it means enough to you, you're going to carve out the time. A lot of people will say, oh, but Stephen doesn't have a life. I find it very, very hard to hang out in the normal fashion. Whatever the terms young people use now, chillax, whatever. What's that? just hanging around doing nothing is very, very, very difficult indeed for me. And maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe I need to learn how to do that more. But really, it's a life of momentum. You reflect as you move. When you move and you go to different places, you're always trying to learn from other people, from other professions, from different age groups. In case of being open, being alert, And I think all of these things rub off onto your martial arts practice as well. So even when you're doing all of these other things, just the idea of alertness, being aware of your surroundings, what the Japanese would loosely call zanshin, for instance, an all-around awareness, that's a lifestyle that feeds into your martial arts practice. You know what's going on around you. It's your job to know what's going on around you. And I find that very, very beneficial. So although I'm very busy, engaged in so many different things, in a very curious way, those different things lead to a much more integrated lifestyle than most people would imagine. Mm-hmm. And in this integrated lifestyle, martial arts practice is just a natural part of what goes on with everything else. So yeah, after I finish talking to you, I'm off to the park. I'm going to do my exercises. I'm going to wear a mask. I'm going to be a good boy. I'm going to go through my routines, do my kata, all of the kinds of things that you would normally expect any martial artist to try to do in a dojo. But of course, the dojos are shut right now. And I find a secluded corner of the park. I'm socially distant from everyone else. I don't care if everyone is looking at me. I'm just going to do my thing and try to be dignified and not fall over. As I yeah.
That's the one thing, isn't it? Don't fall over. Yeah. So which way to phrase this? So you were awarded an OBE for services to Africa, and you once recounted, I forget which article or where it was that I read this, and it was, I think, on one of your early trips to Africa, and you saw some people practicing a style of karate and they had no teacher, and you were like, I know this kata, or I can show you how to do this, and you just ended up starting to teach people kind of by accident in different places, going, I know that kata, or do you not have a teacher or whatever? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was, just as you say, a total accident. When I went to Africa, I had no wish whatsoever to be a martial arts teacher. I'd gone there as a diplomatic actor. And I was involved in development issues and conflict resolution issues, which is a very polite way of saying standing in the middle of war zones and hoping no one would shoot you. The last thing I had on my mind was that I should teach the martial arts. Now, I'd been the assistant instructor back home in New Zealand at the Hombu Dojo of my instructor. He had a large a series of schools. So I had some martial arts experience in terms of teaching, but that wasn't my ambition. I have to be very, very frank. And that is, when I left New Zealand, my basic idea was get to third dan and retire. Typical young man's ambition, get to third dan, there's a nice level, win a few medals, then start growing up and being an adult and doing adult things and have a serious life. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out like that. And I really do have to thank or blame Africa for making sure that retiring from the arts in my 30s didn't happen. People obviously wanted instruction, they were very serious. Many of them became lifelong friends. And from way back, from the beginning of the 80s, so we've been together for more than 40 years now. So you're looking at something which has been very, very fulfilling. And at the same time, something that's been very, very helpful to me, the amount of experience that you gain from that. And what it's led to, because it's been a teaching career, 40 years if you start from the African experience, but longer than that if you count the assistant instructor experience back in New Zealand, it's led to the creation of an organization in which every single member group has a teacher who's either been taught by me or by one of my senior students. We're not an affiliating organization. We don't just take people in. Everyone's got this personal connection. And as I say, we've got over, we don't really count, because in Africa it's almost impossible to keep a decent count, but well over 1,000 students and probably about 50 dojos around the world, which makes it a medium-sized martial arts organization. And as I say, it's all done without charge. In fact, I and some of my close friends put in the money to keep it running, particularly on behalf of the poorer countries. Mm-hmm. So you've got here something which is fulfilling because you see people developing. And particularly in the poorer countries, then the old adage that you got from the American ghettos of boxing your way out of the ghetto, well, kicking your way out of the slum is not a bad comparison. Mm-hmm. As I say, we encourage these people who do well to go on to education. Mm-hmm. We'll pay for it. If you want to become a mechanic, we're going to pay for your city and guild certificate exams. Mm-hmm. We're going to pay your polytechnic fees. You just get a black belt first, mm-hmm. to show us that you've got some serious discipline. Mm-hmm. And that's your qualification to be considered for some kind of bursary to help you with local fees. So it works very, very well. And we make a point of helping men and women, and of developing female black belts. Mm-hmm. And we partner other martial arts charitable efforts. We're partnered with a group called Fair Fight, operating out of the Netherlands, that especially caters for young female karate students in disadvantaged areas of the world. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've given a lot of money and help and personnel at the Fair Fight. And someone who's now very highly regarded in the WKF rankings, Alton Brown, for instance, who is a contender, a genuine contender for a medal, should we ever have the Tokyo Olympics. Mm. He's now involved with that and has gone out to Varanasi, a city in India, to help the disadvantaged young women there. So that kind of thing finally is more rewarding than all the championships. Mm-hmm. In every single country in which we're established, we've won the national championship. Almost all of the major teachers have won international medals of one sort or another. I mean, I myself am still on the international circuit, although I very much hasten to add at the very politely labeled master's level, which means for the old codgers, we basically call it the Zimmer frame category. But basically what it means is that if you're going to encourage your students to do this kind of thing, as well as learning the traditional side of things, and as I said, we're very big on that. But if you're going to encourage this kind of crossover, you better be out there showing them. So even if you don't win anything yourself, the fact that you put in the time, you went on the diet, you made the weight, you went in there, you did your kata, you took your bruises. All of that, I think, maybe I'm speaking rashly here because there will come a time, obviously, when I won't be able to do this anymore. But I do think that a master of a large organization has got to do this. If you don't set the example, what are you doing? Mm. Are you one of these people who stands in front of the class or sits in front of the class barking instructions while you grow fat? The day that happens, I'm retiring. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. And then in terms, I guess finally, because I know that you're very busy, I'm gathering, and you want to get training as well while the sun is out. You have written some works that focus specifically on martial arts. I mean, do you think that you'll go back to writing any academic stuff or any, and you've written some literary pieces as well, haven't you? I mean, what are your plans in terms of writing around martial arts in different ways?
There are no plans to write anything substantial on martial arts. Right now, so far as I am saying or writing things about martial arts, they're an interview format, like what you're doing now, for instance.
Yeah.
I recently did a long interview with Patrick Wisnowski of the English Goju Karate Federation, for instance. So that kind of thing, certainly. Putting pen to paper in a sustained fashion, there's nothing planned along those lines right now. Maybe one or two shorter works, but right now I'm trying to write three academic books for three different publishers. And you yourself know, as an academic, it really is now a publish or perish world. And you better get the numbers out there, and they better have what they mysteriously call impact factor. Otherwise, you're dead. And it doesn't matter if you're a ranking professor, the way you fall from grace is so rapid, it's ridiculous. particularly in these times when university life is becoming more and more difficult and will become more difficult because of the after effects of the coronavirus. Basically, our lives now are making our quarterly numbers like any other profession. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy writing, and I enjoy, I must say, shamelessly negotiating with the publishers. Again, you're quite prolific, so you'll know exactly what that involves. But it does mean less time for writing on martial arts subjects. But I'm always very, very happy to make time to be interviewed by people who know what they're talking about. You do, not everyone does. So this kind of contribution, I'm very, very happy to make indeed.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's been really great to speak to you. I was just thinking it's been 5 years, actually, since we first met, since the first conference in Cardiff. And I mean, things have, I was just looking at that your keynote before my internet went off about 20 minutes before we were scheduled to talk. And you said then this is going to be the start of something, whether you like it or not, it's going to be the start of a new field.
And it has been. And before you sign off, can I say something which might embarrass you in front of the people who might be watching this?
Okay.
I mean, in that time, in those 5 years, you've not only written a very great deal more, but you yourself have now been promoted to a full professorship. You've pioneered the start in this country of formal martial arts studies. I think that your viewers and listeners should appreciate your accomplishment and what you've done for all of the rest of us in establishing foundations and fora by which we can really come to appreciate some of the deeper meanings of the martial arts in our modern difficult world. So I really wanted this interview not to pass without my taking the opportunity to say, well, look, Paul, thanks so much for everything you've done for all of us.
Well, thank you for twisting it around at the end there. That was, lovely. No, it's always a pleasure, and it's wonderful. You're an incredibly generous and helpful colleague, and it's great to talk to you again. Maybe we'll chat again in 5 years' time, eh?
Well, let's make it 4 years rather than five.
Okay, let's do that then.
Okay.
Professor
Stephen. Okay, young man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye.